What is capitalism and is it moral?
Capitalism is not a system. It's the default of what people arrive at once they try to figure out how to thrive in this world. It means that you have to invent property rights. You have to have a system for documenting and enforcing those property rights. And then people figure out how to trade, how to save, how to invest. And the result is what came to be called capitalism in the 19th century. That's not the best name. I'm not one of those guys that works really hard to get us to stop using the word capitalism. I think everybody kind of more or less knows what capitalism is. So I don't have a problem with the term. And is it moral? Absolutely. It's moral. It's the very essence of morality because it amounts to a series of a social consensus around rules concerning what you own and what I own and what are the rules of engagement between us. And that's the essence of morality insofar as it affects social systems. The society cannot be moral without capitalism, strictly speaking.
My fellow sheep, election season is upon us. Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan flock of sheep whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains. Because the government is here to help you. How can you help CATMUF help you? By only voting for candidates dedicated to expanding government. It's easy. You don't need to study the issues. No matter what a politician says when running for office, they're all dedicated to expanding government. And make sure you tell all your friends and family to vote for more government. Here at CATMUF, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. CATMUF, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network on solpodcast.org and theconsciousresistance.com. So today I'm delighted to have Keith Knight, 22-year-old voluntarist coming in from Phoenix, Arizona. He is on YouTube as Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone, and then on Twitter at @AN_capitalist. And then BitChute, he's on Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone, no spaces. And Minds.com, Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone, same thing, no spaces. So he has been quite popular recently on the Tom Woods Show and various other podcasts being interviewed and interviewing other people. And he made a wonderful 5-hour and 10-minute video called The Ultimate Red Pill. And it features a lot of prominent voluntarist, anarcho-capitalist, free market thinkers just discussing these topics, these concepts. And I believe the reason that you made it is, I think you said it's a lot less time than going to government school. So 5 hours and 10 minutes from that perspective, it's not that bad. So, Keith, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on. I love the title, Peaceful Anarchism.
Yes, no problem. When I first made this podcast, I was thinking of a name. My wife was very nervous about me, saying the word anarchism or anarchist online. And so I'm like, well, let's just call it peaceful because, everybody knows I'm a peaceful guy, just to clear up any misunderstandings. And so that kind of put her at ease. And I think when I talk to people about my podcast and I tell them the name, it comforts them a little bit. They're like, oh, okay, peaceful. I like that.
It's good, yeah. There's a Joe Sobrin quote that's like, one of the great achievements of the state is that people fear the word anarchy, but they don't fear the word state. And that's so true because either you believe in voluntarism and the private property ethic and peaceful coexistence or anarchism, or you believe in initiating violence against peaceful people or some form of statism. So, I love the title, Peaceful Anarchism. Great work you're doing.
Thank you. Yeah, and actually our task as, promoters of this message is to help people to understand that when they go to vote, when they advocate for, you know, taxing the rich and increased regulations and, you know, this law, that law, they're actually advocating for violence and force, which most people do not equate with use of the state. They don't equate that with violence, but we as voluntarists and anarchists, we understand immediately any state action is done at the point of a gun and is not a request. You know, when a police officer puts his lights on, he's not politely asking you, can you please slow down and please, if you can find it in the kindness of your heart, pull over. No, it's a demand. It's a death threat. He's like, if you don't pull over, I'm going to call my friends and we're going to make you pull over.
I loved watching Obama's speech today in South Africa. He goes, it means asking those at the top to chip in a little more. Chip in? Like, is there a box on the IRS form that I forgot to check or leave blank? Chip in? I mean, you can't call home invaders house guests. That's just lying. I mean, you can't call murderer assisted suicide.
Right.
It's so dishonest. And everyone's like, oh yeah, obviously, you know, someone has more, they give more. It's so simple. Meanwhile, here's one. According to a website called Global Rich List, if you make $32,500 a year and you live in America, you're in the top 1% of the globe.
Right.
So just take someone in Honduras or Guatemala. Do they have the right to forcefully take your property or your assets or tax you?
Mm.
The common answer I get to that is state is saying, well, I think we can lift them up without bringing us down. Yeah, well, the same thing applies within state borders, county borders, city or national borders. Same thing applies globally. So getting people to think consistently on that, I think it's a great move that we can use to our advantage.
Yeah, it's the idea of legal plunder, right? as described by Frederick Bastiat, that you know, if any action that's done by the state, if it's done by a private individual and would be considered a crime, is equally a crime when the state does it. This idea of moral exemption. For some reason, everybody understands morality, universal morality, when it comes to your neighbor as private individuals, but is not applied. There's a giant exception known as the state that people tend to gloss over, and so in so doing, cause, you know, excessive harm, rampant harm amongst our neighbor as well as other countries. So, So please, before we get into all that, let's discuss your path to voluntarism. And you know, how you came to this philosophy, and what podcasts or books or authors influenced you along the way.
So basically, I've narrowed it down to, well, originally I supported Obama when he ran in 2008. I sort of saw the state as a different mechanism to achieve things you wanted. I didn't think about it morally or anything. I just saw it as, well, one very easy path to sort of produce education or produce defense or make things more equal or achieve justice. So I supported Obama. I went to Washington, D.C. even. I was super young. But I was, you know, very into him, and that's sort of when I got into politics. And then I started listening to Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity, sort of just to hate watch them. And compared to the leftists, guys like Glenn Beck, I think Hannity's so full of garbage, it's difficult to watch. But Glenn Beck, I think, really is a good guy overall, and he had a lot to teach. So basically, Glenn Beck gave me the principle of why he was against Obamacare. And that principle was, it's wrong to force people to buy health insurance, whether you think it'll benefit them, whether they think, you know, whatever your utilitarian case may be, it's wrong to force someone to buy something against their will. And I said, yeah, that's a great principle to have. That makes total sense. And that stuck out to me more than anything else. You know, he gets into the Federal Reserve and everything, and, you know, George Soros. But that more than anything really stuck out to me. And unfortunately, it took me 5 years to apply that principle consistently which just goes to show you the extent of state propaganda that exists. So even when I was trying hard to fight it, and I had the principle given to me, it's wrong to force people to chip in or to buy something. You can persuade them. You can do what Jehovah's Witness does. You can do what the Mormons do, go door to door, offer to sell you stuff in return, schedule meetings to inform you. You can do any of those. The fact that it took me so long to apply that simple principle is a little discouraging, but just trying to make everyone else's path easier, especially with this new documentary. I really think just applying the force principle consistently of force is only justified in defense and holding the state to the same standards I would hold any other person or group, I became a voluntarist.
Yeah, the idea of Obama for me also was a big catalyst. That's kind of when I started getting into I never really cared about voting. My mother, you know, my family's all Democrat, and so 2008 comes around, and I didn't really care about voting, but my mother wanted me to vote, so I'm like, who should I vote for? She's like, Obama, so I voted for Obama. But then I realized quickly that's when I started learning about economics and what the state is, and the nature of government, and you know, quickly learned about all that, and never voted again, and don't recommend anyone to vote. I have since atoned for my sins, so I will not do that again. You know, we all make mistakes, right? Nobody's perfect, right?
It's difficult, yeah, especially when you've condoned it. And that's what, you know, when I go up to, you know, your average status, like my dad, who for probably 20 years has been advocating hardcore left statism, and for the last at least 6 years has been making multiple Facebook posts a day advocating left statism. To get that person to admit they're wrong is so difficult. So one thing I've been focusing more on now is a guy, Scott Adams, who sort of talks about the psychology of cognitive dissonance, of how when you say something, the other person will almost hallucinate what you actually said. So when you say, it's wrong to initiate force against peaceful people. This includes taxation, which is compulsory payment for goods or services. What the other person will say is, so you don't want schools, so you don't want defense.
Right.
But you literally didn't say that, even though in their mind that's what they heard. So Alex Jones says to Bill Ayers, you know, I'm so sick of the government, you know, taking over and controlling so much. And Bill Ayers goes, so you don't like roads? He literally said,
you got something against asphalt? What's going on? Flat? You don't like flat surfaces?
I'm good with flat surfaces, but when there's paint on them, then I really get pissed off.
The paint. I draw the line at the paint. That's where I draw the line.
And every quarter mile, there can't be light. It has to be every half mile, or else I get super pissed off. But so Scott Adams is valuable there. When people will attempt to hallucinate your position and give it back to you, I'm against initiating violence against peaceful people. Some will often say, so everyone is like an island, so everyone does everything by themselves, no cooperation.
Right, right.
What this is they literally see the state as the only mechanism of cooperation, when really it's the antithesis of civilization, of cooperation, because they're engaged in compulsion.
Yeah.
If I were to say, you know, I'm going over clean someone's house in exchange for money, we'd consider that work. But if I were forced, I'd say, hey, someone's trying to enslave me, and we would not call that civilization or cooperation. We'd say that's the antithesis.
Right.
So when the president of France comes out recently in favor of a draft or, you know, compulsory state collective service or whatever they call it, the fact that people don't automatically see that as a claim of ownership over the populace is a sick sign of mind control that it's really difficult to get around. And the other thing I've been doing is Larkin Rose has a seminar called Candles in the Dark. I've done 4 hours of interviews with Larkin
Ooh.
to to discuss this further.
Nice.
And basically, the candles in the dark method is using sort of a Socratic method to talk to statists and not debate them like you versus them, but to get their opinion on, say, when is it okay to put someone in a cage, just me, when can I do it, versus when can the state do it, and why are those standards different? Mm-hmm. If after voting, me and my friends vote to take away your house, but we're going to sell it and give the proceeds to a charity, well, if you wouldn't allow me to do that, why does this group called the government group have such different standards? So Larkin Rose is doing a great thing called Candles in the Dark, where he goes around giving seminars. I'm not sure when the next ones are, but you can look that stuff up.
Yeah, I have heard about those seminars, and I've heard. Yeah, he's really doing wonderful things, you know, with the Blender project. What's it called? The Mirror. Sorry, the Mirror with the using the Blender program. Yeah, that's really awesome. And you know, his speeches. I mean, I tried to get an interview with him, but I could not. He said he was a busy man, too busy. Maybe he freed up his time. I don't know. but yeah, so. Yeah, it's really amazing. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of, there's a quote by Murray Rothbard where he says, you know, when people equate civilization with the state, they're, you know, it's one of the greatest non sequiturs. You know, it does not follow that when there is civilization, it is due to the state. Rather, it is more like when there is civilization, it is in spite of the state. The state is the parasite on the industrious host, right? The host is actually producing the wealth, producing the goods and services, and the parasite simply siphons off a portion of that nourishment, of that creativity, and squanders it and uses it for itself, does not produce anything, just merely weakens the host over time, right? So, yeah. It's a, you know, like when you look in history class, they often say, like, you know, we had... you know, we were living in caves, and then we were nomads, and then we were, like, doing all these different things, and then eventually a state formed. Cities and a state. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And then we had kings and pharaohs. Go ahead, sorry.
I love how their image of history is everyone lived in caves, and then labor unions and regulations came along,
right,
and
right.
Then things just started, like, shooting out of the ground.
Yeah.
And then finally people could build. Like Tom Woods always, he just used it in his recent Mises talk. He's like, it's not like all the bad parents are in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
And all Bangladesh needs is for politicians to take the pen, write down no kids can work, and then have the police enforce it. It's like, well, then the kids would starve.
Right.
But then again, at least the happy progressives can call that a win on there. We ended sweatshops. We raised the minimum wage. Yeah, but all the unseen effects you bastards can't appreciate.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I recently got into a pretty great conversation because I teach chess at a camp in the summer where my kids go to. And I was talking to this one woman, this counselor. She's 24. And I don't know what she is on the political spectrum, but, you know, she was telling me that she likes to buy something like winter clothes in the summer because it's cheaper, right? And I said, aha, this is why I think pretty much everybody understands basic economic principles, even though they don't know it, right? You are responding to supply and demand, right? And so, and then I mentioned price gouging. I'm like, do you know what price gouging is? And she's like, no. I'm like, it sounds like very violent and dirty and bad, right? Yeah. It's basically when, you know, yeah, gouging your eye out, right. And actually, side note, one of my favorite quotes, one of my favorite cartoons about price crimes, quote unquote, is this person goes to a cell, you know, is just arrested in prison, goes to a cell, three people are in the cell, and the person asks the three people, what are you in for? And the first one says, I'm in for raising my prices too high, so the price gouging, I'm in prison. The other person's like, I'm in jail for making my prices too low. I was in prison for undercutting. And the third person's like, yeah, I'm in prison for having my prices just right. I'm in prison for collusion. you can't win, you know?
you can't win.
And so, yeah, so I was talking to her about price gouging, about emergency situations, and you know the state comes in and applies laws to suppress the increase of price that should naturally occur with scarce resources in an emergency environment. And guess what? Guess what happens? You get hoarding. People buy up everything because they know everybody needs it. So like the first couple of people buy up all the necessary food items, either food or water or gasoline, and then they jack up the price anyway, make a profit, and sell it at the same price that would have been if the state had not imposed these laws. And the other thing is, you have shortages because, like, say for example, gasoline. Trucks did not even like where I was living in Long Island when Hurricane Sandy happened. Trucks did not even want to deliver the gas because they knew it was not worth their while because they could have sold it for higher. And yet the state was not allowing them to raise the price because the demand was so high, and so they did not deliver the gas, and so there was further exacerbated the shortages, right? And so yeah, so
that's like when Chris Christie and Barack Obama are hugging each other in New Jersey after the hurricane. They're like, one thing the left and right status can really come along on more than anything else. Not just war, genocide, mass murder, but they really come together when it comes to economic illiteracy. Like, who wants to drive there? Who wants to go drive into this hurricane? It's going to take a lot of financial incentive for a truck driver to bring goods in there,
right.
or to bring water,
right.
or gasoline.
Right.
Now, they can see this when it comes to basically – say, take cigarettes. If you increase the price of cigarettes, they call it the sin tax. Well, people are less likely to purchase them. Same with anything else. But they don't see it when it comes to, say, the minimum wage. If you increase the price of employment, then less jobs are going to be taken.
Right.
And it will increase unemployment amongst those with the least amount of skills and experience.
Right.
And the fact that they can't see it right in front of their eyes, is unbelievable. The price gouging. You know what's a big gouge? A $4 trillion government that produces nothing but misery. I'm going to call that a price too high. Maybe it's a case of projection or transference on their end. But yeah, the price gouging thing is pretty incredible, especially when you see Paul Krugman saying – like decades ago, he's like, yeah, well, when there's rent control, you take away the incentive for builders to continue building and produce a higher supply, lowering the price over time. But this doesn't happen. And Thomas Sowell said to Dave Rubin, he's like, yeah, I got so fed up with telling congressmen and women the reality of economics that I just stopped going there. So, yeah, the economic illiteracy. Oh, this is a great book. It's called The Economics of Freedom, What Your Professors Won't Tell You, and it's the best works of Frederick Bastiat.
Ah, nice.
And Tom Palmer at the end. It's called 20 Myths About Markets by Tom Palmer, and he just shoots down the top 20 very quick.
What are your favorite books that you have read that really like inspired you, educated you, and also podcasters or YouTubers that really helped you to learn this content?
So books, I would say The Most Dangerous Superstition by Larkin Rose, Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard, Against the State by Lou Rockwell, Meltdown by Tom Woods was a big economics jump because a lot of times it's like, all right, yeah, the state's inherently illegitimate. But when you have a free market, you just get business cycles. Well, Tom Book's Meltdown absolutely obliterates any superstition you might have that people cooperating voluntarily is dangerous, more so than a state controlling the economy or regulating it. Another one is How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes by Peter Schiff.
Yeah.
Another one was Private Governance by Ed Stringham. Also, Anarchy and the Law is just a collection of works by Edward Stringham. Stefan Molyneux's book, Practical Anarchy, was really good. I would say those. Also, a non-political book that's just so fun to read is called The Use and Abuse of Logic, How to Win Every Debate by Madsen Pyrie Madsen-Prairie. He's the head of the Adam Smith Institute. And basically, he just goes through like 130 logical fallacies. And when you're able to think more clearly, it helps you a lot in debate. So, yeah, that also The Law by Frederick Bastiat was really one of the first things that exposed the fact that the state is coercion to me. So, oh, also A Theory of Socialism and Capitalism by Hans Hermann Hoppe. That was an amazing book as far as explaining what capitalism really is. Is it capitalism bosses and buildings and money? Well, no. Capitalism is the institutionalized recognition of the private property ethic and the non-aggression principle, whereas socialism is socialism, fascism, communism is all the institutionalized aggression against the private property ethic or individual rights, really.
Right.
So understanding it on that level where you have anarcho-capitalism, and then on the other end of the scale, you have communism, capitalism, and socialism. That really made things clear to me. So, yeah, those. Now, there's some great historical books also. The Real Lincoln by Tom DeLorenzo, or How Capitalism Saved America by Tom DeLorenzo. And it's just incredible to learn that you get so many historical myths where it's like, you know – And that really is where the state's power rests, because anyone can just compare Netanyahu to Winston Churchill, and we know Netanyahu's a good guy. You compare Trump to Hitler, and we know everyone knows Hitler's a bad guy, which, of course, he was. But the fact that people are able to make up their minds about historical figures without reference point is very discouraging. So you can read in The Real Lincoln by Tom DeLorenzo, Abraham Lincoln in his first inaugural address says, if the South does not comply with the moral tariff, there will be bloodshed. He says something to that extent. In other words, if they don't comply with Union laws, then there's going to be an invasion.
Right.
It's not me defending slavery. Again, people will say, so slavery is a good thing? No, of course not.
Neo-Confederate.
I know, really.
Slavery.
Okay, another one. In 1858, his debate with Stephen Douglas, he says, yeah, I really have no interest in making equality of the Negro. The Negro shouldn't vote. The Negro shouldn't serve on a jury. And certainly there shouldn't be intermarriage. I think the best way to treat this is to give them – he sort of had like this pre-Liberian plan where you would ship blacks back to Africa. Now, the point in that is that we see, you know, the country as this, you know, sort of dead, immoral place, and then Lincoln comes and saves it. Much like a religion, we'll see the world has fallen until some special entity comes and saves it.
Yeah.
That's really what the state is like. You get another one. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Are taking too long.
Go ahead. No. It's fine.
It's crazy to come across these. Okay. So then you have, a couple decades later, the sinking of the Maine, which there's actually an explosion in a U.S. ship at Havana Harbor, and then William Randolph Hearst and his newspapers sort of conspire with the military intelligence and the industrial complex of that time, which was much smaller, to say that the Spanish were responsible for the explosion. Now, this, the fact that the U.S. went to war based on faulty intelligence in 1898, so long ago, and the fact that it's not discussed is pretty incredible that it should be well known by now. Another example of this is the Lusitania, a book by Colin Simpson called The Lusitania, and a book called Room 40 by Patrick Beasley refute the idea that, well, the Germans sank the Lusitania and then the U.S. went right to war. Well, there were actually not only 2 years in between, but Colonel House, Woodrow Wilson's head advisor, spoke to a British ambassador, Sir Edward Grey, to say, you know, if there was to be the sinking of an American ship, the U.S. would spring right into war on the side of the British. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And then in Pearl Harbor, and this is the last one I'll do. All right, the Gulf of Tonkin's also a too cheap of a one, or the USS Liberty. But the Pearl Harbor one is really important because so few people know about it, but everyone knows about Pearl Harbor. You have a document called the McCullen Memo by a guy named Robert Stinnett, who made this popular. General Arthur McCullen was the one who wrote out this memo saying, here's 8 ways we could get Japan to strike America, and we could justify America entering the World War. Because the country was so isolationist at that point. They sort of – I guess they still had that George Washington spirit of don't get involved in European wars. Mm. And the U.S. lost 116,000 men in the First World War, slaves being conscripted, of course. Mm. So the McCullen Memo says here's 8 ways we could get the U.S. – to get Japan to strike America, and they used this in what was called the Export Control Act of 1940. They then froze Japanese assets in America as an act of war. Now, those ones that just came to mind, the fact that people still see the state as the savior, and without them, bad things might happen, is so freaking ridiculous. And I'm sorry, I went on way too long there.
No, it's okay.
But that just pisses me off that people with PhDs don't know what, like, the Levon affair was. And that was an Israeli false flag where they said, hey, let's stage an event and blame Palestinians so we could get more land in Israel. The Levon affair of 1954. So those are so it was between books and historical events that I sort of came around to. Voluntarism, as far as podcasts, Stefan Molyneux and Larkin Rose were the YouTubers that really got me here.
Wonderful. Yeah. You know, I am guilty of the crime of buying so many books, more books than I can read. That's my problem. I have many, many economics, philosophy, books about voluntarism, capitalism, free markets, about history, and finding the time to read them is one thing. But yeah, the Lincoln, I have that one. I started, never got around to finishing it. Yeah, I got the what is it? How Capitalism Saved America? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one. I have that. Yeah. So history. I've read and studied a little bit of history, but for me, I guess I focused more on like the philosophy, the morality, and the economics. For me, that's my focus. Like when I talk to people about these concepts, I try to relate, everyday occurrences in their lives and kind of illustrate the coercion, and define basic terms like what is the state, what is taxation, like when somebody. Like some anarchists are more like they want the shock factor. You go up to somebody like, I'm an anarchist.
Really? Yeah. I'm so against that. That's funny.
Yeah, I'm not like that at all either. I don't label myself at all unless they really ask, and I'll say I'm a voluntarist, and then just like you said, they ask you what that is, and that's a good starter for conversation. But I'm more about the Socratic questioning. I probe them. I ask them questions, about morality and what relationships in your life is voluntary. Your friends, your spouse, your employer, the businesses that you patronize, right? These are all voluntary relationships in your life. And then what's the largest involuntary relationship in your life? And one, because I'm around a lot of homeschoolers, because I homeschool the kids, and I'm around a lot of other homeschoolers. And so one woman said, schools. I'm like, yes, exactly, schools. Now, government school is symbolic representation of the state, right? And so just expand it outward, and the state is the greatest involuntary relationship that we all have to endure in our lives, right? And then you get them to think about that kind of stuff, if I can't steal, rob from my neighbor to pay for my things or to pay for my child's education, What if I get a bunch of people, a group of people, 100 people? Is that okay now? Or 1,000 people? Or 1,000,000 people? Is it okay now? Or what if I elect somebody and tell them to steal it for me? Is that okay now? And I love that the light going on in their head, and especially when they say something like, "Oh, I never thought of that." You know, and it's so my conclusion when I talk to people about this is most people, you know, they're just ignorant. They don't understand what they're doing when they go to vote and when they support a politician. You know, they don't know that there's violence entailed in that action, or the politicians use violence to carry out that action, right? And so once we can expose the gun in the room, expose the violence, the coercion in the state, then only then we will appeal to their humanity, to their compassion, right? And once you have that, then it's just easy sailing after that. So go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's really interesting when sort of using these methods, once you really grasp the understanding of voluntarism, to use it on people who are, you know, considered like high profile in society, mm-hmm. to use them on doctors, lawyers, people with masters, bachelors, and doctorates, mm-hmm. and to see them respond emotionally to something that's so important, the state. It's not like, well, the Hell's Angels, well, they're a group, but, you know, they're not that big. Right. When you think of the state and they really haven't thought it through,
yeah.
that puts us really at a distinct advantage of being the first to sort of get people to really think consistently about this. Because when they do, because Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump aren't getting people to have an understanding of the role of the state in society.
Right.
Whereas if we're the ones who are really exposing the reality of it, that's such a great advantage to be at. And that's why these shows, I think, are so important.
So let me ask you, when you meet someone like completely new and you want to introduce these topics to them, how do you go about doing it? What's your method?
So I sort of will find ways to let people know that I advocate libertarianism or voluntarism are the words I most commonly use. And I say, and basically what I mean by that is I just hold government to the same standards that I hold everyone else to. And at the end of every law really is the threat of violence. So what you hear is you should pay someone $12 an hour minimum wage. Well, what if I don't? Always ask, well, what if I don't, to understand the nature of your relationship with a person or group.
Right.
Because you have to be able to opt out in order for an interaction to be moral and for there to be genuine wealth created. The fact that you have to bring up wealth is sort of to get their attention, but what's more important is morality, because I know so many lazy people that if you enslave them, they'd be way more economically productive, but it doesn't justify enslaving them. So the moral case is more important. But the wealth case is when people interact voluntarily, you know that if you don't produce a good product, then people won't buy it. So that makes producers, employees, everyone else, much more likely to produce better products. And it makes consumers happy, and it also doesn't force consumers to purchase something against their will. So there's a general wealth creation that both parties will benefit if they can go into this thing voluntarily. And that's why you see freer societies so much more wealthy, because the more freedom people have, the more voluntary exchanges people have, the more wealth is created amongst them, whether it's products, goods, services, or employment. So it's hard to I've tried to not have one universal way. I will make sure that every person that I come into contact with has understood or heard the non-aggression principle. There's an interesting, you know, psychological understanding of the human brain where if you hear something once, you're likely to forget it. But hearing it a second or a third time increases the likelihood of you caring about it, yeah. recognizing it as legitimate.
Right.
It goes up like 20-fold, which is so incredible. But when you hear, you know, constantly like, China's manipulating their currency, therefore we need tariffs, yeah, or something like that. But by the time you've heard that 5,000 times, people pretty much believe that it's in the science of economics,
yeah,
that free trade hurts, you know, your country, when the opposite is true. So I communicate to people. I can't really say there's an underlying theme, but my next work that I really want to do is to have some sort of man on the street interviews and see how well I can communicate the message on the spot. And I want to do like 95% totally calm and reasonable. And then I just want to come up to like the worst Bernie supporters or the worst Trump supporters and just grill them and see how they react. Because I do recognize at some point you do have to scare people out of advocating their policy or increase the amount of insecurity they have, because it's very unlikely someone's going to say, "Oh, I have been advocating the initiation of violence. Ooh, that's real bad." And then the police and military are going to be like, "Dope, I should just get a job at Jack in the Box instead." because they're so entrenched into it that's really difficult. So you got to come off as either very cool or just make them insecure about their policy. The only reason people like the Young Turks or Secular Talk or the people at Fox News are so passionate about what they say is because they have a sense of security in their ideas or talking points. If you take that away, it's another great way to defeat statism, not just using logic and comprehension skills to explain the principles to others.
So let me ask you, have you heard of Cal Mulaney?
Yeah, I actually had an interview with him on my channel. I think it's called Understanding Libertarian Anarchism or Debating Libertarian Anarchism.
Awesome.
Cal Monolet and Keith Knight. So yeah, we had a really good talk.
Yeah, he does some awesome. I don't know, does he still do the Man in the Street? I haven't seen recently if he's done. He still does it?
Yeah.
Okay, I have to check his YouTube. But yeah, he's been doing it for a while, a few years, and yeah, I really like his style. You know, he's very, he's very non-confrontational, and he basically focuses on the economics. I think on the morality as well. But he really gets people to understand the basic principles of non-aggression and why the state is inherently immoral. And I think he does a wonderful job. He does have those videos where he confronts the communists. That's that's a little bit different style, but yeah, he has a formula, and he's very good at delivering it and at coming up with the quick replies. And yeah, I think you should definitely give that a try. I think that'd be great. I would love to do that. I live near Manhattan, and I think that would be really fun to go with a friend, with another volunteerist and just talk to people on the street and record our conversation. You know, I wish so many of my conversations I've had with people were recorded so that I can, I so wish that. I wonder how it would look if I take out my phone. Can you just keep talking? I'm just gonna do this for a minute. Don't mind my phone.
But the caveat has to be a secret recording, because when someone knows they're being recorded,
right.
Then it's like, okay, I got to defend them. I gotta say anything to defend myself or make them look bad.
Right.
That's why at the Candles in the Dark seminar, Larkin Rose does not tape record the interactions that they do with the other person. So, for example, I brought one of my friends up, and Larkin pays him $50 for 15 minutes, so it's a pretty good deal. If they'll just answer questions from someone like me who's done the seminar, and I just asked him, "You think there's anything moral, like dealing with morality? Is there anything government can do morally that, say, Apple can't morally do?" And this is a smart fella that I know. So I didn't just bring up some doofus to try to make look bad. And he had a really long – it was probably a 5 or 6 second pause, which on a stage in front of 50 people, that's a long time to pause.
Mm.
And the average person I don't think is willing to sit, pause, and ponder when they know they're being recorded and it could be on YouTube like that if the right person uploads it.
Right.
So, the cost and benefit of – That would be a really good one. Hidden camera status style. You'd have to do like to catch a status or to catch a predator. You just catch the status initiating violence.
Nice.
And then you have all the papers there from their Facebook posts. It says right here, you advocated Hiroshima. You want to explain yourself there? Is it okay for anyone else to nuke the U.S.? I've got it right here. Uh-huh. And then when they come outside, Adam Kokesh punches them in the face.
Sounds like a promising idea for a new sitcom. So let me ask you. Remind me of an interesting idea. When me and you, let's say, when we talk to people, and then they slowly begin to understand, you know, that the state is violence and immoral and coercion and all that, and then instead of, you know, saying, okay, maybe we should have, you know, maybe a world completely without the state, or, you know, voluntary interactions or anarchy is preferable, how about can we meet in the middle somewhere? Maybe if we have a voluntary government, maybe if we have a voluntary taxation system. and to me, it kind of reminds me of Larkin Rose when he says, like, you know, it's really black and white. It's like either it's voluntary or it's involuntary. Either it's sex or it's rape, right? Either it's you give your money or the money is stolen. How can it be partial rape or partial theft? Like, how is that possible? And and so that's what I tell people. It's like, if it's voluntary taxation, well, first of all, that's an oxymoron. Taxation by definition is coerced, and if it's voluntary, then you can't call it taxation anymore. It's just buying a product or a service. And if the state's services are voluntary, then it's no longer the state. It's just a business that can't punish you for not purchasing its services. And you know, hallelujah, now you're in the free market, you know, now you're a business. So I found that idea interesting, you know, partial. You ever come across that, people say that?
That's great. You sort of just trick them into your own principles. Like, there's that great meme. It's like a bunch of these hippies, and they're like, you know, screw capitalism, you know, just like, if you want to just like buy our stuff, you know, buy it. If you don't want to, whatever, you know, we're selling this stuff. Uh-huh. And the bottom, it just says, just don't tell them it's capitalism. Let them do whatever the hell they want. Because their mind really is. Well, no government is chaos. Capitalism is, you know, a boss exploiting the worker for right. profit. Right, there's right. a stock market.
Right.
I just know that those things are bad. So that's why explaining the principles is so important. And something a lot of people miss, that a lot of people will respond to me, you know, through Twitter in direct messages, just asking, so what's the difference between Lowe's charging me a fee for, say, buying a refrigerator and the government taxing me? Well, one is forced, the other's not. Well, if I don't like Lowe's, I can go somewhere else. And if you don't like this government, you can go somewhere else. What's the difference? The important difference that the statist has yet to understand is that Lowe's is making rules with regard to its property that it has acquired through voluntary transaction or original appropriation. This unique state attribute is that it claims rulemaking powers and violence initiatory ability, morally, the ability to do so on land it hasn't acquired through voluntary exchange or original appropriation. So when a moron comes up to me and says taxation is the same thing as rent, rent is theft, you're just sitting back doing nothing. I'm like, first of all,
rent is theft.
I'm like, first of all, there's not going to be an incentive to build and take the risk of building apartments when you can't make rent money. But second of all, it's the difference between, you know, making something and selling it versus saying anyone who makes anything, I get a cut of.
Right.
So, again, this is a blatant principle that people should be able to see through, but there's so much propaganda that even the smartest don't want to see it. Even someone as brilliant as Ayn Rand, who the more I read her nonfiction, I'm just like, gosh, this woman was incredibly brilliant to escape the Soviet Union and everything and still become an American intellectual in your second language.
Yeah.
She doesn't even know it, but she talks so much trash about anarchism, and then two sentences later advocates anarchism. She's like, the essay is called "Funding in a Free Society: Government Funding in a Free Society," and she's like, yeah, the only way governments can issue taxes, but they could do something like, we'll enforce contracts if you want us to, and we'll charge a fee. And it's like, but an important stipulation is these fees, you can only voluntarily use this contract government service. Anyone else can provide it. You don't have to use them, but maybe that's one way. Well, then that's just a contract enforcement agency that anyone else would have the right to do so,
right,
as you admit. So, that was – I'm totally forgetting your original question.
No.
well
– No, we're talking about – I mentioned the idea of, why don't we meet in the middle? You got anarchy, complete, no state, and then you got state control and coercion. What about in the middle? What about partial – state, voluntary state, voluntary taxation. the idea that that's an oxymoron, and it's basically black and white. There's no middle ground. You're either pregnant, the woman's either pregnant or she's not pregnant. All right, there's no halfway being pregnant. Are you pregnant?
Yeah, really.
So
well, maybe that's the trans agenda. They want you to be so confused they don't know if a man can be pregnant or not. So they're like, there's 78 genders. All right, there's 78 genders. How many can get pregnant? I used to think only men and women and women could get pregnant. Maybe that's the goal. To justify taxation, they confuse us with all these genders. You don't know anything that's true.
Or maybe some men want to get in on the action of, I don't know, what do you call it? Like birth control or Planned Parenthood or whatever these government benefits.
Yeah, really. hey, boss, my period's acting up. Can I go home early? Really, George? Really? That's your excuse?
I didn't tell you my pronoun of the day, so yeah.
I just felt a kick. Hold on. I think I might be pregnant.
Yeah, right. So yeah. It's interesting these topics getting into with everyday people and trying not to scare them away, as you say trying to plant some seeds for thought, go ahead.
Okay, here is what I would do if someone, were asking me, what about meeting halfway or something?
Right.
That's someone who sort of believes in – well, if they do say that it's voluntary, then they're taking all the state – what makes government government. They're taking all that away, and they're pretty much with us. But a common fallacy is the fallacy of compromise. In other words – one person wants six, another person wants zero. The right thing to do is have three.
Yeah.
The reason it's important to not give any ground with that is people think then morality is determined by the average of whatever's proposed to them.
Right.
So if they say, we want to nuke Japan four times, well, other people want to nuke Japan zero times. Well, then Harry Truman was obviously right to only nuke Japan twice.
Wonderful.
So that's important. What I would respond to that person is you really have to get at what the state is. In the same way, you wouldn't just start saying, let's argue over a verse in Exodus or Leviticus or the New Testament. You say, okay, first we have to determine if the Bible is a legitimate document, if it's a historical proven document, and then we'll get into the details. First, we have to decide whether the state is a legitimate entity and whether the state has a right to have a monopoly on certain goods or services or abilities that no one else has the right to. So Sargon of Akkad says, well, we need someone to enforce contracts and we need courts, okay? Why does government get to – if we need taxation, why does this group, the government group, get a monopoly on that? Is it because they're so much smarter? They're so much more moral? They know history so much better? Right, they understand right. economics so much better? Why this group? Mm-hmm. And when you just hold up that group and say, well, can me and my friends do that? Can Walmart do that? Can the people at Bose Speakers do that? Well, then they just start laughing. They're like, no, what the hell? Or I once said to a woman who was like, ha, Catholics are such idiots for believing, you know, the Pope has some special power. And I just said, what if every 4 years you got to vote for a different Pope? Then would it be okay for the Pope to force you to fund the church? Would you then have to follow the commandments that the church or all their edicts, would they then have the right to regulate you?
Right.
And when we hold the state's perceived legitimacy up to any other person or group, you just have to laugh at it because yeah. it's so ridiculous. So I would say to that person, really find the foundations of what the state is, because that's someone who's trying to avoid a real conversation when they're just like, oh, I'll meet you in the middle.
Yeah, you mentioned a book about logic. I never heard of it before, but logic and learning logical fallacies is actually a wonderful way to learn how to quickly disentangle a person's argument just with logical fallacies. Like, you don't even have to go into the the arguments yet. First you say, you know, that's an appeal to the stick, you know, that's an appeal to antiquity, that's appeal to authority, and then what you mentioned, I believe it's called the golden mean fallacy, appeal to the golden mean. And my favorite example of that is if one person says we shouldn't build a bridge, the other person says we should build a bridge to the whole side. How about we just build it to the middle? And everybody will be happy.
I get that so often when people are like, well, you know, we have the right and the left, whatever they mean by that. They just mean the Republican voices and Democratic voices.
Right.
Like, we got these people over here. We got this. What we got to do is come into the middle. I'm like, they both advocate violence.
Yeah,
like,
right.
The problem with the Bloods and the Crips is we got to bring them together and find which violence overselling crack is really justified.
We got to unite the violence.
I know. Wouldn't that just make things worse? If they were together and more powerful. Ben Powell always says, you know, I really love gridlock, because gridlock is when they don't get anything done, but they sell it's bad. Even better than gridlock is scandal, because you get gridlock and you expose the bastards for who they are. He goes, Monica Lewinsky is basically a libertarian hero.
Nice. Or actually, another way... Describing a traffic on a government road, talking about gridlock, traffic on a government road is just standing in a long government line. You're basically in a government line when you're in traffic. You know, it's like if the roads were privately owned, you know, there would not be so much congestion, so much traffic, and the roads would not be in such disrepair because probably most likely cars would have to pay. In proportion to how much damage they do on the road, which is not what happens. Basically, tragedy of the commons, right? The larger, huge 18-wheeler trucks are the ones really that damage the roads the most, yet they don't really pay anything extra to actually drive on the roads. So, yeah, you were going to say?
Exactly, yeah. And the way roads started, according to Walter Block's book, Privatization of Roads and Highways, is that originally road builders for horse and carriages, they would charge you the thicker, I think it was,
right,
the thinner your wheels, the more damage they would do. Think like ice skates would sort of push harder on them, so they would charge you more. Now, this is important with the immigration debate because there is a lot of what Hoppe refers to as forced integration. I still don't advocate closed borders. But there is something to the extent of people coming here and can get free access to a great number of things.
Yeah.
And this bears a very large financial burden on others, whereas no such thing would occur if you had toll roads or some way to pay for roads. Look, traffic is shortages for roads, basically. Hmm. And in the same for the same reason we get bread lines when FDR virtually monopolizes the agriculture industry, because government produces shortages. Right. They have no incentive to produce a good product, so everyone's pissed off with something, but they don't have the ability to go anywhere else.
Hmm.
And their kids don't learn any different because they're in government schools. So, yeah, anything. We really got to have a Rhodes libertarian candidate, because if most people can think privatize the roads, anything else is pretty easy from there.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. And so you said shortages, you know, anything the government controls becomes a shortage, as well as they can't. There's no price system, so there's no way to rationally allocate resources because they have no feedback from the consumer. You know, so, I don't want to keep you any longer, but wonderful conversation. So, please reiterate your contact information if people want to follow your work.
Well, basically, my current claim to fame is making a video called The Ultimate Red Pill. It's 5 hours and 10 minutes long, the equivalent of, one school day. You got 12 years of government nonsense. Just take one day to learn some freedom. Got a lot of great people in there. Penn Jillette, Dave Smith, Tom Woods, Stefan Molyneux, Robert Higgs. That is basically what, if I could just ask one thing for people to watch and check out.
Yeah.
My contact, you can find me on YouTube at Keith Knight Don't Tread on Anyone, on Twitter at @AN_capitalist. You can find me at Minds.com and BitChute.com at Keith Knight Don't Tread on Anyone.
Yes, yes, please check them out. Check out the video, wonderful video. Share it with your friends. A wonderful resource. So Keith, before I let you go, I often ask my guests, what is your favorite quote of all time?
My favorite quote of all time, I would have to say, you know, one that comes to mind is probably Larkin Rose when he says, this really attacks the legitimacy and necessity of the state. In one quote, he goes, if people are so, you know, nasty and evil and terrible, well, then we can't have a state that basically allows for a subset of those same nasty people to have societal power to control forcibly all the others. And then a close second is Stefan Molyneux saying, you can convince people to give up half their income, get their entire lives regulated, but we can't convince people how roads would work without coercion.
Right.
Where the hell am I?
Right, right. Excellent. Excellent quotes. I mean, to me, the state is a magnet for the wicked and the scum and the vile and the reprehensible among us. You know, those seeking power, I think J.R.R. Tolkien said, you know, no man is fit to rule or boss over another man, least of all those who seek out the positions of power, right? And Tolkien, you know, admits to being a voluntarist in one of his letters, I believe. So, yeah, awesome. Go ahead, you want to say
that? You hear that, Kissinger? We're right on your ass, pal. We know what Kissinger and the Bush crime family are up to.
Well, yeah, saying politicians are criminals is just a redundancy, you know. but we repeat ourselves. So
unmarried bachelor.
Yeah. So awesome conversation, Keith. Thanks a lot for coming on. Really appreciate it. So this is Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network on solpodcast.org and the Conscious Resistance Network or theconsciousresistance.com. Wishing all of you have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this content and would like to see more of it, please feel free to donate and help me interview other fascinating people. You can do so through Patreon. That's patreon.com/peacefulanarchism to help me out. $1 a show is all I ask. If you feel so inclined to donate more, please feel free. It will only assist me in spreading the message of freedom and voluntarism that much farther and that much more efficiently. You can also donate to my Bitcoin. My Bitcoin address is in the description to my videos as well as on my website, peacefulanarchism.com. And while you're on my site, there's a donate button to donate through PayPal. If you prefer to donate through PayPal, you can do so with that. But Patreon is a little bit easier for content creators, as you can set up a recurring donation if you so desire. Also, while you're on my website, peacefulanarchism.com, please feel free to sign up, enter your email address, sign up for my newsletter, and you'll receive updates every time I post something, a video or an interview. I do not send out any spam. Or you can also follow me on Facebook, under facebook.com/peacefulanarchism or facebook.com/DaniloCuellar3, I believe. DaniloCuellar3. So either one of those methods, if you are able to donate, I would be most appreciative. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a magnificent day.
Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. Cell 411 because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at GetCell411.com. That's GetCell411.com.